time that my love by the gasworks wall dreamed a dream by the old canal. I kissed my girl by the factory wall, dirty old town. Dirty old town. Clouds are drifting across the moon. Cats are prowling on their beat. Springs a girl from the streets at night. Dirty old town. Dirty old town. On the smoky wind, dirty old town, dirty old town. I'm gonna make me a picture box, shining steel, tempered in the fire. I'll chop you down. Get out the train. Dirty old town. Dirty old town. I met my love by the gasworks wall. Dreamed a dream by the old canal. I kissed my girl by the factory wall. Dirty old town. Dirty old town. Dirty old town. Dirty old town.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Studs radio show about what, Marielle?
Comic books and geeks and awesome things.
Awesome. My guest this week is, I didn't check to how to pronounce your name, Jeff Lemire?
That's right.
That's right.
That's how you do it.
Hooray. We were just listening to an oldie but a goodie, Pogues off Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash. Probably their best album. I'd say it's their best album.
Yeah.
Dirty Old Town, lovely little ditty by Shane McGowan, the man with the nicest smile in the West. How you doing today?
I'm doing good.
You're doing good?
Yeah.
Jeff is one of Canada's rising stars. Can I say that, Jeff?
If you like, sure.
There we go. a proud Canadian boy, eh?
That's what I am.
There we go.
I'll agree to that one.
There we go. Okay. You eat Tim Hortons donuts and lots of bacon.
Yeah.
There we go. The three books, first off, is the Mammoth Essex County from Top Shelf. The I don't want to call it an omnibus because I have this weird thing about the name omnibus right now. The Complete Essex County.
Yeah.
We'll call it that. And The Nobody from Vertigo, which I quite enjoyed. I enjoyed all this stuff. And Sweet Tooth, which just started last week.
Yeah.
Your new ongoing series. You've put out a lot in the last 2 years.
Yeah, I'm lucky that I'm a fast drawer.
How old are you?
I'm 33.
Okay. Now, let's, I guess, start out with what got you into comics. Your early days of loving comics and development of cartooning abilities and however that goes.
Yeah, well, I grew up like probably most people. I just, you know, grabbed whatever comics I could find at the corner store or the grocery store when I went shopping with my mom when I was a little kid, and most of it was, DC or Marvel superhero stuff, and for whatever reason, I always had a stronger attraction to the DC stuff. I was never a big X-Men fan like a lot of guys our age, but...
Don't worry, I'm not either.
I was, a big Teen Titans and Legion of Superheroes fan.
You know, I could never get the Legion of Superheroes. I just never understood
that. Yeah, a lot of people have the same... You either don't get it or you're a fanatic. There's not much, you know.
Well, what would draw me to the Legion of Superheroes?
I don't know what would draw to you now.
Now that I'm not a pubescent boy.
Yeah, when you're 8 years old, a bunch of superhero teenagers in the future is pretty cool.
Named Cosmic Boy and Lightning Lad and Saturn Girl.
There you go. Come on.
How did these things...
One big superhero soap opera in the future. You couldn't go wrong.
Now, the Teen Titans, I understand.
Yeah.
They were good.
Yeah.
Not to say that the Legion superheroes weren't good. It's just, I guess, so much baggage within it.
Yeah. Well, there are about 40,000 characters in the team, so that doesn't help.
And it's all in the future.
Yeah. I just grew up reading that stuff and was always drawing comics ever since I was, 4 or 5 years old, just constantly copying stuff that I'd bring home. And, it was never something I aspired to do as a living, for sure. I just, it was always my passion. And as I got a bit older, my comic taste obviously changed, and I got into a lot of the early Vertigo stuff when I was sort of in my... probably mid-teens or whatever, Hellblazer and Sandman and all that stuff, and then from there that's the gateway to Dan Klaus and Robert Crumb and Charles Burns and all that great stuff. And then
sounds familiar to myself.
Yeah, and there's no going back after that, so I went away to school in Toronto from, obviously I grew up in Essex County, and
so it is an actual place.
Yeah, it is. It's Windsor is part of Essex County. Windsor is sort of the biggest town in Essex County.
Oh, okay.
There's a bunch of tiny little farming communities surrounding that where I grew up. So.
See, in BC, we don't really have that whole county
aspect. Yeah. Well, it's your loss, trust me.
One of many things.
Yeah. So I went to film school in Toronto, and I was going to be a great movie director, I thought, when I was 18, that dream was crushed really quickly, and when I realized how expensive film is and how hard it is for someone who's kind of introverted like me to try to communicate any kind of honest idea through a whole bunch of actors and a crew and everything it takes to make a film, it just didn't suit my personality at all, so... probably near the end of me studying film, I got really, really back into comics again and started to see that as a way for me to tell stories again and to just be able to sort of have an unfiltered kind of way to express myself. And that was probably, I graduated 10 or 12 years ago, and I just started drawing comics every day and just did a lot of really, really bad comics for a long time.
A lot of stuff we won't see.
Yeah, it's really bad stuff, but, it was always, hopefully always developing and pushing forward. And then I got to the point where I started putting out mini-comics and stuff, and everything else kind of happened really quickly within the last, three, four, five years.
Yeah, it really seems like it all kind of snowballed real quick.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like a lot of stuff came really fast, but there was, like I said, there were years of thousands of pages of comics that,
just sat there.
No one saw.
Well, that was just like, I remember when the Essex County books came out separately, and there was there's going to be a book, and it just seemed surprising that young, just seemed all of a sudden out of nowhere, there's just this volume of greatness. I was really surprised by Essex County. Like, oh, it looks good. And then just, there's so much depth to it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I had sort of an advantage in that I was completely finished the first volume before I found a publisher. So by the time that actually got picked up by Top Shelf and they got it, you know, put it out and everything, I was already well into the second volume. So I think that's why everything seemed to come so quickly.
Now, tell me about the nexus of Essex. I didn't mean the alliteration.
That was pretty good. I at that point I'd been away from home for living in Toronto for like a decade or so, and with anything, when you kind of get some distance from a place where you spend a lot of time, you get a better perspective on it. And when I was a kid growing up on the farm in a small town and stuff, I hated it and couldn't wait to leave. But as an adult looking back, I could kind of see it with, you know, fresh perspective. And so I kind of wanted to go back and sort of explore that, what it was like to grow up in a small town, and really use that as a way to explore what I knew as, I guess, the Canadian experience, which would be, you know, small town life, family, hockey, comic books, whatever else, you know, was important to me growing up. And it kind of snowballed into this big epic following, you know, one fictional family over almost a century in this small town.
Mm-hmm. So. Is your own family have that kind of interconnectedness with the community?
No. I think it's all, like anything, when you start to write fiction, you romanticize things and you make nice little connections and thematic, you know, connections here and there, and you build things around a structure where, you know, real life doesn't really follow those kind of neat little structures.
Well, that's the thing, I guess, with Essex, especially, is it's a really isolating story. Like, you don't really see a larger community there.
Yeah, you really do just see that one family, and you kind of get a hint at how they may be connected to the rest of the town. But it's really, you know, it really does follow one family story in a small community. And when you're growing up in a small place, really often you don't know much beyond your own family, you know, until you kind of leave and see the world at large. At least I didn't, you know.
Hockey.
Yeah. I love hockey. I've always played hockey since I was a little kid, and I still play every week now. And
what's your position?
I'm a left wing. Yeah. I said that weird, didn't I? I'm a left wing.
It's like, I'm a communist.
I'm a left winger. How's that?
There we go. Yay.
So I play every week, and I follow the Leafs passionately, and I really, to my mind, there hadn't been a great hockey graphic novel yet. So I would be lying if I said I didn't kind of have aspirations to create that. So I don't know.
Well, it's funny
or not, but I tried. You know,
I like, hockey's an important part of it, but to me, it didn't seem like it was the fact that it was hockey, but more that something had to unite the characters.
It was. It's really important to me. I mean, I'm really passionate about hockey, but it was important to me that it could be, like, anyone could pick up the book, anywhere in the States or here, and they didn't have to know anything about the sport to really understand what I was trying to communicate. It's just a metaphor. You know, it's a vehicle to explore characters. And it was important to me that, you know, hockey is important to it, but it's not, I don't know, it's about family and it's about the characters, and hockey just happens to be one of the unifying kind of things that kind of follows this one family over the generations, and you don't need to know the sport or be passionate about it to really.
I think the one interesting thing is maybe the role or the juxtaposition the Leafs play, or not necessarily juxtaposition, but the how that kind of rise and fall kind of goes with the characters' lives too in time.
You know, I actually didn't plan that, but now that you mentioned it, it is kind of funny how the fall from greatness that the Leafs experienced after the 60s really does follow the main character there, and that's kind of interesting. I hadn't really noticed that until you
just kind of like a crescendo.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there were some good times later on with Dougie Gilmore.
Blips on the radar, you know?
Yeah, and
I
so
love
that's...
the Dougie years, but, yeah. I have hope. I'll never give up hope, you know? Because, you know, a hockey fan without hope, you might as well just be a Senators fan then, you know?
Oh.
Oh.
That was just mean.
I know, but they deserve it.
Yeah, well, I'm a West Coaster, and... I'll admit I actually haven't been a very devoted hockey fan for the last several years, but I'll still support the Canucks.
That's the thing about hockey. You can go away for a few years, and it's always...
You'll, get back. We'll back always back. Have this deep, undying hatred for the Calgary Flames.
Oh, see, I like the Flames.
Maybe we'll just have to end the interview now.
That's fine.
Actually, I'm going to do a quick song break, because we're about 20 past.
Yeah, sure.
Any song you'd like to hear in particular?
Is this one of the ones I picked? Or?
It's all stuff you picked, and I was able to find that Pride of Egypt track.
Why don't we play that one, and then I'll explain why I picked that afterwards.
All right. We'll be right back with Inkstead, CITR 101.9. My bad, I played the wrong song.
That's okay.
That was Vancouver's very own Destroyer with Chosen Few.
Yeah.
Very good track. Very nice.
Yeah, I listened to a lot of Destroyer when I was drawing Ghost Stories, so I thought I'd pick one of those tracks.
Perfect. It was a swell track. I hadn't listened to, I don't think I've even listened to the album it's off of, so.
Yeah, I love that one.
I'll check it out. Just for folks listening, I'm talking to Jeff Lemire right now. His books are Essex County, The Nobody, and Sweet Tooth. Up next, I'll be playing an interview I did earlier today with the very fantastic Jerry Moriarty. Week after that will be Brad McKay about the Doug Wright Collection, and also the organizer of the Doug Wright Awards, which my guest right now, Jeff Lemire, is one of the recipients.
That's right, yeah.
Apropos moment of mentioning, you've won a fair amount of awards for the old Essex stuff.
Yeah, I did really, really well with
it. You're cleaning up, yo!
I had a good year last year with the awards, for sure. It was nice. But, you know, that's probably the last award I'll ever win. So.
Oh, shush.
You know.
Now, The Nobody is kind of a... It feels almost like a continuation of Essex County to me. Is it?
Well, it's certainly...
Same community?
You know, really, I started it pretty much immediately after finishing the last Essex book, so there wasn't really a lot of time to step back and, you know, evolve between projects, for sure. So I think it's not surprising that it feels like a continuation in some ways, and I think more than a continuation, and maybe it was a bit of a reaction to the Essex County stuff, and just that I wanted to, you know, still explore those themes that I enjoy exploring in my stuff, but maybe put a little twist on it and tell a little more of like a pulpy kind of genre story as well with it, and kind of turn some of the themes of Essex County on their head a bit and have some fun. So.
Yeah, and you really played up. I love the little faux covers in there.
Yeah, those were fun.
That was the different genre of great DC comics of days past.
That's right.
So how did that project come up? Did the DC just really love Essex?
One of my top shelf editors or publishers, Brett Warnock, he was good friends with Bob Schreck, who was at the time an editor up in Vertigo. So Brett had kind of mentioned that Bob was a big fan of the Essex County stuff and that he would probably be pretty receptive to me sending him some stuff. So on that tip, I kind of pitched a few things. The Nobody being one of them, and you know, it got approved fairly quickly, and it just kind of started rolling. So it was kind of just good timing, and you know, knowing the right people.
That's funny that most publishers probably wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I know, but Top Shelf, are those guys are like family. They, you know, anything they can do to help, you know, they're gonna do, and vice versa. We just, it's not, you know, they know that me doing a Vertigo book is just gonna get more people to
read Essex.
To buy Essex County, which has already happened, so, you know, they know what they're doing.
So, tell me about the process of going from working by yourself to working with Brett and Chris, because I know they're a lot more, or they are pretty hands-on publishers.
It really, like I said, I had already finished the first book of Essex before I approached them, so at that point I kind of established, you know, the kind of story I was telling and the way I was telling it. So for Essex County, there wasn't a huge amount of sort of hands-on stuff. The first two books especially, I kind of just did them and they published them, to be honest with you. And then, but then with the third book, definitely we went through some drafts, Chris and I. Chris has a really strong story sense, and we both agreed that we just really wanted the third book to, if maybe it wouldn't read as well as an individual graphic novel as the first two, but when it was going to, we knew it would eventually be collected, and we wanted just to make sure that it was a strong final chapter to like what I had done in the first two books. So we were like I said, we went through a few drafts before we were kind of happy with what we had, and Chris just has a great sense of helping me tie everything together and, you know, cut out the things that were necessary and just move me in the right direction. So, yeah, all positive stuff. You know, I love working with someone like that who whose opinions I respect and who, when they do throw ideas at you, they're always the right ones. So
it's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a discussion I've been seeing nowadays, especially on the Comics site, talking about the role of editing in comics.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious, like, has it, working with that, did it build your own storytelling skills or kind of give you a new lens at looking through things?
You know, that's the kind of thing that it's probably still so close to me. I don't know how much that, you know, working with those guys has affected me yet. I probably need some more perspective on it because I just finished those books about a year and a half ago, and I've just been constantly working since then, so I haven't really it's hard to, sometimes you don't really step back and get that kind of perspective on your own work until much later on, you know. So,
in time.
Yeah.
One of the big things of Essex County is, like, it's kind of a mix between, like, loneliness and isolation.
Sure.
But the fact that the characters aren't alone.
Yeah. That's right. That was a nice answer.
Yes. I mean, yes, it is.
it's about how in a small community like that, you're so far away from other people, like physically, often, you know, and the sense of isolation, the loneliness can be pretty incredible, but in the end, even though you're so far away from everyone, your family and everyone else is always so close by, and you know, they're always there no matter how far away you go. You always can kind of come home to them, and I think that's sort of what the characters, I guess, learn over time, is that, you know, no matter what they do, their family is always there.
There's one part which I really loved, and I actually used it in the interview I was doing earlier with Jerry Moriarty, was talking about the part with the one brother in the city, and where he says the city doesn't become a part of you, you become a part of it. It
yeah.
soaks you up a bit by bit, year after year, yada yada. I won't read from a comic because no one really wants to listen to a radio show where someone reads from a comic. But that was, like, one of my favorite parts of it, is that kind of that contrasting of being even more alone in
yeah,
this in bigger city. Atmosphere.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I think the reason I couldn't wait to get away from home when I was younger was to be alone, because it was just so hard to have privacy in my family, and just to kind of, it was so hard for me to kind of become my own person at home, and I had to get out and go somewhere big like Toronto, where I could just sort of get lost in the crowd and find myself on my own, you know. And I, having lived in both Toronto and Essex County, it just seemed like such a great way to explore two different paths brothers could take and stuff. So.
The kind of the path you did take, or you could have taken?
Yeah, I did take. And, you know, I think at the time, and probably even more now, I'm just feeling more and more suffocated living in a city. And I'm more and more thinking about moving, not back home, but to, you know, another small community where I can just be quiet and alone again in that way. So,
well,
I guess it's just something I'm always going through personally as well.
The fascinating part with that story, though, is that you see what happened to the brother in the city, and it's about his life in the city, and that doesn't really talk about what happened to the one brother when we went back home.
Yeah.
And that kind of, like, leaves you with the what happened, you know, what did happen, why, what changed with him, and...
Yeah, it's...
The big what if.
Yeah, sometimes, I don't know, sometimes with stories, storytelling, it's... It's as important to know what not to show what to show. You know, you have to be a big part of writing a story, and I guess in any medium, is just self-editing. And yeah, I think it worked where we followed the one brother because I think we needed to see him lose track of his younger brother as well. We needed to see kind of, he didn't really know what was going on with his brother because he had kind of cut off contact, and so we're kind of seeing it through his eyes, and like him, we don't really know a lot about what went on in those years except for when he goes back. So I think hopefully it kind of worked out.
It's one of my favorite things in good storytelling, where you leave stuff to the reader's imagination. Like, we don't need to be told every little
bit. It's a big
bit.
Part of how I tell stories, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just, when you start showing everything and just, like, pulling back every curtain and, like, what's left? You know, what's left? There's no mystery, no mood, no atmosphere. So you gotta, it's always a balance between what to show and what not to show, you know?
But it makes a good complete set.
What's that?
You've made a good complete set there. Now, the Nobody, how influenced were you from, like, was it Jules Verne that did the Invisible Man?
H.G. Wells. Yeah.
Same
guy. It's actually, they were the same guy. I don't know if everyone knows that or not.
Really?
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh. Don't lie. This is radio.
The book isn't an adaptation of the novel, really. It's, you know, I've always loved those old H.G. Wells and Jules Verne novels, those sort of turn-of-the-century adventure sci-fi things. They're just so fun, and I thought, I love the, visually, I just love that bandaged character. He's just so fun to draw, so I just thought it was like a perfect visual kind of symbol for, you know, themes of identity and paranoia and stuff, and to throw that character into a small town and kind of just do my own thing with it. So, you know, other than taking just the initial kind of setup of the novel, and it really isn't, you know, it doesn't really follow the same plot line or whatever.
Not at all.
Other than just sort of, you know, a fun homage to something I enjoy. It's, yeah.
Well, the neat thing to me is that it's not necessarily the Invisible Man.
Yeah.
It's just kind of implied.
Yeah, it could be.
It could be, but and it's up to the reader to kind of figure it out if they believe it's invisible.
Yeah, there's a couple ways you can read the book, and if I've done my job right, there's one way is just as legitimate as the other. So.
Yeah, and it's and I really appreciate that, where it's like you kind of come out of it going, well, it could be this.
Yeah,
it could be.
I mean, that's I love when I read stuff like that or see, you know, see movies like that. Where one of my favorite filmmakers has always been David Lynch, and I just love leaving a David Lynch movie and spending a couple of days just trying to figure out exactly, like, what the hell did I just see, and, you know, what did it mean, and what, you know, and just kind of piecing it together, and just that interactiveness that it creates is so fun, and I don't know, it just cause it's just such a great way to experience a story or something, so I tried to do one of those.
I like to tell people not to watch the last episode of Twin Peaks.
Really?
Like, it just, you know, just avoid it. You know, watch a show up till the second last episode, because they try and do so much in the
I
end.
I like that episode.
You like the backwards talking midget and going through the red curtains.
I love it. It reminds me of my family. So.
All right. An odd family. I'm going to do another quick song break.
Sure.
And then when we come back, we'll jump into a little bit more of The Nobody and The Sweet Tooth, the thing we're working on now. And now I'm actually going to play the song.
Cool.
So
right,
we're back. Inkstud, CITR 101.9.
Rude boys, don't cry, don't cry.
Rude boy, don't cry.
Scenic Drive, every Friday morning, 10 a.m. till noon, CITR.
Avalanche of stones at your arrival. When I press Put your money where your mouth is. We're starving over here. Yes, we're starving for attention. Turn the cameras on us. Let's patronize somebody. Yes, and let's rewrite all the myths that led us up here.
Tarawan 1.9 FM. This is Ink Studs. That song we listened to was Andre Ethier.
Etier.
I'm such a West Coaster. And the track was Pride of Egypt. Now, tell us about that epic piece.
That Andre was a studio mate of mine when I first started drawing comics kind of seriously here in Toronto. And I started just getting ready to start doing a couple of mini comics and stuff. I shared a studio with Andre in Kensington Market for about a year and a half, and so that's my little ode to him. He's a painter as well, and he used to lead the band the Deadly Snakes. And
yeah, ah.
So that's Andre.
There we go. Tell me about your artistic process, because you are incredibly quick.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm just lucky in that the style that I kind of seem to have developed just happens to be one that lends itself to speed. It's just an expressive sort of loose kind of style, and as a result, I'm able to turn out pages pretty quickly, which has certainly worked to my advantage, getting a monthly book and things like that. So, yeah, but as far as the process, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I used to kind of work from really loose scripts, not scene by scene or dialogue or anything, but just sort of really loose plots, and just kind of take it one scene at a time and, you know, write the dialogue for that scene and then draw it. And but now, working with DC, it's gotten a bit more structured where, you know, I have to, basically just because their structure, their editorial system is still set up for, you know, multiple creators working on one title, like, you know, the writer, penciler, inker, or whatever. So you kind of still get paid that way, and the system's still set up that way. So I still have to hand work in that sort of order. So as a result, I kind of have to write full, you know, tight scripts, and then pencil everything, and then ink it. And it's, you know, it slowed me down a bit, but probably in a good way, where I've kind of, it lets me take a little bit of a step back before just diving into everything and just kind of putting a little more polish on stuff, which is good. And hopefully I'm still not losing kind of that loose sort of expressive style that I like. So.
It must be, or one thing that I was thinking about is there's not a lot of, on monthly titles for Vertigo, guys that both write and draw.
Yeah, I don't think there are any right now. I mean,
Dave,
the only one I can think of was Young Liars
with
Dave Lapham, but that got canned, so maybe that's my fate as well. Hopefully not. But, yeah, I mean, even in their history, there haven't really been a lot. I mean, Vertigo is a real writer-driven imprint, you know, from Neil Gaiman to Garth Ennis or whoever else. You know, it's really always been a writer centric kind of place, and then
Lord, there's been some terrible art.
Yeah, well, there's been some good art too, but you know, it's just that, just, you know, you put out enough comics over enough years, it's gonna happen. But I think it hasn't really been a place where a lot of cartoonists or, you know, writer artists really found a home for whatever reason, so I guess, yeah, it is kind of unique in that respect.
Now, tell me about where Sweet Tooth came from.
I don't know.
It just popped up, this little guy with little...
It did kind of pop up, I'll be honest.
Antlers.
I was working on the Nobody, and Bob Schreck, my editor, sort of hinted that Vertigo had some monthly slots that they were going to try to fill over the next year or two, and that if I had anything, you know, he'd be happy to take a look at it or whatever. So I kind of... I don't know where the antler kid came from. I don't know. I think I must have been drawing a kid like that in my sketchbooks, just kind of here and there. And so it just, you know, like anything, most of my stuff just starts in the sketchbook, where, like, you know, Essex County all just started with me drawing a little kid dressed in a cape and a big hockey player, you know, and then their story just sort of grew out of the sketches and the drawings. And the same thing with this kid, of just sort of this kid in the woods with deer antlers. And I just sort of started expanding on it and came up with this big post-apocalyptic action-adventure epic thing that I'm attempting to pull off. So, yeah, I mean, it's full of different influences, you know, from, you know, everyone always mentions The Road, and I can't deny that The Road's a big influence. And but, you know, I love all that old post-apocalyptic stuff, like Mad Max, and, you know, a lot of cool comics like Tim Truman's Scout series and from Eclipse. And, you know, I've always really wanted to take a stab at doing something a little more action-oriented, but do it, make sure the plot and the action and everything is all just sort of in the background, and it's all really just about the characters, you know, and kind of take a different take on it. So that's what this is.
How far out do you have it kind of an idea of what's going on?
I have the whole thing, you know, pretty much written down in stone at this point. It's as far as how many issues it will last, that also depends on sales and things. So I've kind of it's important to me. I mean, starting something like this, it's important to me that I get to tell a complete story one way or the other, so that when it's all said and done, people can go back and read it and be satisfied. And so I know the last issue of the series is already written in full script, and it's just a matter of if that comes at 15 issues or 24 or 36. You know, that all just sort of depends on sales. And I kind of have different plans in my head of how to end it, you know, and get to that same end point at different ways along the journey, you know. So, but, you know, ideally I see it being like a 30 or 40 issue kind of thing, you know, like a 3 or 4 year little journey.
And maintaining the monthly will be no problem?
Yeah, the actual deadlines and getting the work done and on a monthly basis isn't a big deal for me. Sometimes I get a little freaked out thinking about drawing the same characters for 3 or 4 years and not being able to move on to other things, but at the same time, there's something really satisfying in being able to take a few characters and really create like a real dramatic long-term character arc and really explore them and have them grow and change over as I do and stuff, and that's really exciting. So hopefully, you know, it keeps being exciting and I keep finding ways to make it exciting, and it shouldn't be a problem.
So why don't you tell people a bit about the world of Sweet Tooth, like a bit about the character as much as you can.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it can be really complicated to describe, so I'll try my best to keep it simple. But basically, it's this little kid with deer antlers who lives in a forest with his father in our first issue, and he's never been outside of the woods. He's been kind of forbidden to ever leave the woods, and his father has sort of told him that outside it's just full of, you know, terrible things, and they're just safe to stay here. And something kind of happens in our first issue where the kid with antlers named Gus is forced to leave the woods for the first time, and what he discovers is a North America that is just basically empty. It's been decimated by some kind of a mysterious plague or pandemic, you know, about a decade earlier. 90% of people are just gone, and you know, the people that are left are sort of these really savage kind of survivalist types who are hunting down animal hybrid children like him, because they believe the only children born after this pandemic were these sort of animal hybrids, and they all believe that whatever cure for this disease is somehow, you know, buried within these kids, so they're all hunting them. And there's this big bounty hunter dude who kind of teams up with our kid in the first issue or second issue, and it's sort of their road trip across this kind of really dangerous American landscape, and kind of trying to stay alive and sort of solve the greater mystery of what the disease was and things like that. But really, it's just a character drama between these two and sort of their journey together. And, you know, where they start at the beginning of issue 1 and 2 is going to be really different from where they end up. So,
is it a severely depressing buddy book?
It's depressing on the surface, but it's. I'm going to do my best to start throwing some humor and stuff in there later on when I introduce some new characters and stuff to keep it balanced. You know, I don't want it just to be really dark and depressing all the time, or else, you know.
People shouldn't cry so much.
They can cry once in a while, but they got to laugh too.
What's it like doing color work now?
It's really cool. I mean, I don't do the color myself.
No, it's
Jose Villarubia does the color, and he's like one of my heroes anyway. Like,
phenomenal.
He's always been my favorite colorist long before I met him. And I met him through Top Shelf because he had done some work on a couple of their Alan Moore projects, and sort of became friendly with him at conventions and things. And when I got this monthly gig, I immediately asked him if he wanted to do it, and asked Vertigo if they'd be cool if he did it, and it all worked out. And I mean, he brings so much to my art. It's amazing to get the JPEGs every month in my, you know, my email, and to see my black and white drawings come to life like that. It's just so cool. It's really neat. I mean, I don't know how well I'd be as a collaborator in terms of writing something that someone else had, or drawing something someone else had written, or vice versa, but as far as this kind of collaboration with having someone else do the color, it's really fun, because I hate color. I love black and white comics, and that's just how I see my art. I can't really think in color, so it's good to have someone who can.
Are you able to strip back a little bit about how much black you have in there with the color aspect?
No, I haven't changed my style at all, really. I just, if anything, just after I've seen the first few issues colored now, I can kind of see certain places where I might add a little bit more line work to sort of add some texture or something, to differentiate maybe a figure from a background or something. I realize I don't need to do that as much because he can do it with color, but I really haven't changed my style too much. If anything, he's just sort of developed a coloring style that meets what I do, so, yeah.
The needs of the comic.
Yeah, it's amazing. He colors like no one else because most, DC and Marvel comics, when they're colored, they're just so over-rendered, and especially the superhero stuff, everything's shiny and really bright and gaudy and full of gradients and stuff. And Jose does this thing where if you just look at it quickly, it almost looks like flat color.
Yeah.
But then you look closer and you realize it's not flat at all. It's actually really rendered, but it's just done so subtly, and he's really an original for sure.
No, and I kind of like that because there is like a lot of comics where they do, like you're talking about the over coloring, and it just seems it's really muted.
Yeah, it's a very muted palette, and I love how it looks, so I'm really happy with how it all turned out.
And it's a fine book for people to check out. The first issue, a whopping dollar.
I know.
Well, can you say no to that?
They can. They will, but that's okay.
Hopefully they'll change their mind.
And if you mail me your copy of issue one, I'll mail it back signed with a sketch. You can get all the details on my blog. So.
And what is the blog info?
It's just jefflemire.blogspot.com.
There we go. I may send my copy.
Well, okay. You just do that.
All right.
We'll see what happens.
I'll have it back with I don't know what you'll do to it.
Coverless. All dog-eared.
That's fine. I'm actually, my comics are not precious. That's a
rule.
Well,
they're meant to be read, not stored in plastic somewhere.
No, it's always fun finding old comics that have been in those plastic bags, ones from the 80s that are melting now.
Yeah, totally.
And you just got to like pull the comic out, and it's just like, look at that.
Yeah.
No, here's one that wasn't in a bag.
Yeah, totally.
I think we're pretty much near the end of the time slot here. So you've got, to remind folks, Jeff Lemire. The books are Essex County, The Nobody, which came out, I guess, 6 months ago? Less than that, probably.
Came out beginning of July. Yeah.
All right, so they're really recent. And The Sweet Tooth, which just came out last week.
Yeah.
And pretty much just The Sweet Tooth coming out from the next long while.
Yeah, I got a couple little side things here and there. I'm in a couple anthologies coming out. And I'm doing a couple other DC projects that I'm not supposed to talk about yet. So, but there'll be news soon about those. So.
All right. Well, looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks so much.
And have a swell day.
Okay, bye.
Bye. So a reminder, folks, that was Jeff Lemire, and we're talking about his books, Essex County for the Fine Folks at Top Shelf, and Sweet Tooth and The Nobody from Vertigo, D.C. You can listen to more Inkstuds interviews at www.inkstuds.com. Next week, I will be playing an interview I did earlier today with Jerry Moriarty, which was very fascinating, and I think you will all love it. I really enjoyed talking to Jerry, and it really blew me away, a lot to learn, and very much appreciate Jeff taking the time. It was really fun to talk to him. I really, really enjoyed his books, and I think everyone else should check them out too. I guess we'll end off with John Cale, as per Jeff's request. So Ink Studs up next. Luke and Bryce are going to come in and play some records, and then the French Connection will be on at 3:30.
If you would take it and tell everyone. doing fine. I was with you down in Acapulco, trading clothing for some wine, smelling like an old adobe woman. But a William Burroughs playing for lost time. But I was thinking about my mother. I was thinking about what's mine. I was living my life like a Hollywood, but I was dying, dying on the vine. Who could sleep through all that noisy chatter? The celebrations in the sun. The authorities say my papers are all in order. And if I wasn't such a coward, I would run. Meet me when all the shooting's over. You can bring all your friends along for protection. It's always nice to have them hanging around. But I was thinking about my mother. I was thinking about what's mine. I was living my life like a Hollywood, but I was dying.